Thank you so much for coming. I see some faces from last night, which means I didn't chase everybody away, and I appreciate that. All you new faces, welcome. This is an exciting time for me, actually, because right now I get to summarize something I spent 3 years of my life doing. And that was writing a book and making a movie. But I cannot possibly tell you everything there is in that movie or in that book. It'd be forever. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to just take three of the topics, and I'm going to just skip over them lightly. Oh, we're not even running yet. No wonder everyone's looking at me funny. Why am I looking at my Windows background?
How's that? Okay. This is good because I talk with my hands, and when someone hands me one of those, I have to imagine that it's glued to my chest, or else it'll be out here and I'll be talking, and it's terrible. So this is much better. Okay, let me start again. Hello, everybody. Thank you for coming. My name is Dr. Robert Carter. I am a speaker for Creation Ministries International out of our U.S. offices near Atlanta. I happen to be a scientist, but the most important part of my life is that I am a follower of Jesus Christ. And I'm here to tell you that you don't have to turn your brain off when you come to church. I'm going to summarize for you as briefly as I can three of the eight topics that we cover in our award-winning documentary, Evolution's Achilles Heels. We've actually won two significant awards at Christian Film Festivals. I'm very proud of this. In fact, at the San Antonio Independent Christian Film Festival, there were 13 documentaries submitted, and we were number two. We lost to Mike Huckabee. All right, but that's quite okay. We covered things. We covered natural selection, the center point of evolutionary theory, genetics, something Darwin knew nothing about, the origin of life, the fossil record, the rock record, radiometric dating, Big Bang cosmology, and then ethics and morality, which is a very important topic for science, but most scientists aren't trained in that, but absolutely is a very important topic. And in all of that, all we did is we went to all these nerdy PhD scientists who happened to be Christians and Bible believers, and we said, okay, Mr. Scientist, according to your area of expertise, what can evolution not answer? That turned out to be a powerful question. See, most of the stuff that CMI does, we're defending creation. We're spending our time answering evolutionary objections, answering people's questions. But this one, we turned the goalposts around and we said, no, we're going to play the game on their side of the field. We're going to make them defend our best arguments against them. And I think there's a reason why this is one, I believe, the best-selling book that we have at the moment. Now, it's got a long way to catch up to Creation Answers book, which is 30-something years old. But we have sold a huge number of these, and the number of comments we've gotten from Christians just saying thank you is phenomenal. So if you haven't seen the movie or read the book, there's a couple copies out there left. You might want to avail yourself. Now, I am a marine biologist. I cut my teeth studying the coral reefs in Florida. It was a wonderful, wonderful job. In fact, that green color you see there, that coral head, that was my dissertation, because I ended up in the genetics lab. And once I figured out, first of all, the green color was a protein, and the red also, I said, oh, proteins are coded by genes. I can steal the gene. And once I had the gene, I engineered them into these fish, and I made the Frankenfish. My degree ended up in genetic engineering. But you know what? That's a scary topic, isn't it? Just yesterday, I read an article about the first time anyone's ever cloned a monkey. Two monkeys in China have been cloned using the same technology they used to clone Dolly the sheep. You know what that means? There's nothing preventing us from cloning human beings. Nothing at all. The technology's right there. Now, if you think this is completely immoral, we got to be careful. It is immoral from a pro-life perspective, because in order to make those monkeys, they had to discard most of the embryos that didn't develop properly. They got like 2 out of 90 or something like that. That's a really bad success rate. And if any of them had developed abnormally, they would have just flushed them down the drain or terminated it. And if we're playing around with human lives, that's a big problem. But fish lives? Maybe fish fall under our purview given to us by God in the first chapter of the Bible. he's talking to Adam and Eve, and he says, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over every living thing that moves on the earth." You know that's a justification for science? Think about it. Have dominion. Be a steward. To be a steward means to take care of, but to take care of, you have to understand what you're taking care of. The pursuit of understanding is called science. Why does science exist? Because God gave it to us so that we could fulfill our role in God's created order. And as we learn more about science, actually, we glorify God because we're studying what He did. And if you spent time studying science, like probably many of you in this room have, you probably have been overawed by the complexity and beauty in the natural world. Why? Because it comes from the mind of our beautiful and complex God. You know, we've been writing about how science and the Bible work together for 40 years now in our Creation magazine. When we're over, I'm going to give you an opportunity to sign up if you'd like. I know some of you saw this last night, so you already know what to do. We also have a gigantic website, creation.com. Now again, I know many of you do spend time on our website, and I really appreciate it. If you're not familiar with creation.com, just go there. There's a little search box up in the corner. Right up in here. Oh, wait a minute. There we go. Right up in here is a little search box. Type something in. Anything you like. Some question. Some keyword. And I can almost guarantee you that we have an article on that because we have 11,000 articles. Pick a topic. We've tried. And if you don't like our answer, write us an email. We'll answer you directly. In fact, sometimes those turn into new articles. As Heinz said earlier, I have not always been a creationist. I don't really like that term very much, but I don't have a better term. I have not always believed that the earth is fairly young. Excuse me, I was totally sold out on evolutionary theory, totally sold out on millions of years, because that was science, and that's all the science that I knew, and everyone I grew up with, and everyone I knew growing up, and even into college, well, they believed this. And I remember seeing things like this. Remember Pachycetus? That cartoon picture was the thing that convinced me that evolution was true. Who can doubt evolution? Evolution is a fact, I said. Look at that. It's perfectly intermediate between land animals and aquatic animals. It's exactly what we were looking for. What I didn't know at the time was that that cartoon was based on those blue bones that they found. And then a short time later, they discovered the rest of the skeleton. It turned out really to be more like a 7-foot-long rat. And the only similarity between whales is some of the inner ear bones. It is not at all transitional. And I said to myself, I think I've been lied to. Because you see, there's a philosophy happening here. Evolution is not just science. It's a philosophy of history. And when someone finds something, they interpret it according to the philosophy that they've already accepted as being true. But you know, we've got more information on this topic than any other time in church history. We should be shouting, the Bible is history. Yet most people in our culture have never heard anyone defend the Bible. They've never run into a Christian who actually believed it. They've never run into a Christian who is bold enough to proclaim it. That's the majority of people in our country, not just in this uber-liberal Northwest corridor. It's true in Georgia also. Most people, they may have gone to church all their lives. Tons and tons of people have gone to church all their life and don't know anything about the Bible. I was one of those people. I was a statistic waiting to happen. But if we look at the statistics, it's kind of humbling because we realize, depending on which survey we're talking about, this is the number or percent of young people growing up in church that are going to leave church and never come back when they grow up. And if you think that's some liberal denominations, that 88% comes from the Southern Baptist Sunday School Board. What is happening in our culture today? Well, our culture today is rabidly anti-Christian. I am glad I'm not a teenager in today's world. It was hard enough in the early 80s growing up in that environment, all the sex and the drugs and all this stuff. But today, if you're a Christian, you are mocked. You people with more gray hair than me, that wasn't true when you were growing up. Maybe a little bit, but not like today. We went. We took a video camera. We went to all these college campuses, and we interviewed all these students. And we said, we only had three questions. We said, first question, were you raised in church? If they said no, we said, okay, thank you very much. Were you raised in church? Oh, yes, okay. If you were raised in church, were you ever taught anything about creation? If they said no, we said, do you still go to church? Every single one of those students, except one exception, said, no, I don't go to church anymore, man. If they said, yes, I was taught about creation, we say, do you still go to church? Every single one of those students says, yes, I still faithfully go to church. Now, if we had sampled tens of thousands of people, of course, there would be some, you know, it's not a perfect sampling scheme, but it was a profound revelation to us that all of, and we're talking about dozens of students that we interviewed, if they had been taught about creation, if it was part of their upbringing, if they discussed it at the dinner table, they were strongly likely to retain their faith during those very trying, difficult late teens, early 20 years. Now, if you think college is what's making atheists out of our children, it's not true. I read a survey a couple months ago. Actually, people growing up who don't go to college are more likely to renounce their faith than those that do. It's not college. It's the culture. And you can't escape it, especially with the internet, because now the culture has come steamrolling through your screen right into your bedroom. If you would like some help with this, now I know some of you already do get our email newsletter, but if you don't get our email newsletter and you would like some encouragement, once a week we're going to put together something new or interesting or something informative, and we're going to send it out to all the people on our list. This is really interesting. Every once in a while, we'll hit a topic where more people will click on the link, because we can count that, and read our article than the number of people we sent it to. What does that mean? It means our people are forwarding these on to their family and friends, and it's sort of a witnessing tool. And every once in a while, we hit a good one. It explodes. And that's our goal. Go viral. If you would like to get this, it's really easy. Got a handy-dandy volunteer who's going to hand out. The sign-up forms look just like this. If you're not interested, no big deal. Just pass the person next to you. So they're going to be circulating while I'm speaking. Pass them to the end rows when they're done, please, so we can collect them again. I appreciate it. All right, here they go. We're talking about science. Science is a tricky word because most scientists can't define what science means. Science has different meanings depending on the context. The type of science that you learned in middle school, 8th grade-ish, 7th grade, 6th grade, you learned how to observe and repeat and test. That is called operational science. It is the bedrock of all of our modern technology. Everything we know about science in operational fields comes from that methodology. Interestingly, that method was pioneered by Christians. Men like Johann Kepler, who gave us those three laws of planetary motion that NASA used to get that rover I just showed you to Mars. You ever struggle in science class? Some of you certainly did, right? Remember those horrible formulas with all those letters and symbols? Oh. You ever realize that just about every time you see a letter, it's the initials of a Christian's name? What? Absolutely. Most all the science that we use today was founded by people who believe the Bible. Why? Because the Bible commands us to study, and the Bible tells us that God is complex and God is brilliant and God doesn't change his mind. When you take that thought and apply it to science, the world should work according to scientific law, because the ultimate lawgiver built the world, and God never does anything against his own nature. So of course the universe reflects the mind and character of God. That thought is what propelled modern science. But wait a minute. How come most scientists today aren't Christians? Because there's other forms of science. One other form, a very important form, it's called historical science. This is when you're trying to reach back into the past and try to figure out something that happened that you didn't see. But wait a second, history is not repeatable, is it? It's not testable, it's not observable. We don't have a time machine. You can't fly back in time 50 times and shoot Hitler, and then fly back in time 50 times and not shoot Hitler and see what the course of history happens. You can't do that. This is not the same thing as operational science. But the entire evolution creation debate is wrapped up, not in the boiling point of water, in are Neanderthals a dead end branch of humanity? first is operational science. The second is historical science. So that raises a question. Is evolution a fact? Is it a fact? Yes or no? How do you know? How do you disprove a philosophy? How do you disprove a view of history? That's hard, isn't it? We can't go into the laboratory necessarily and automatically discount evolution. It takes time and dedicated effort, and you have to be able to tease apart different ideas that aren't necessarily something that's, you know, 1 + 1 = 2. And one of the problems that we've had is that most of us, not the younger people, but most of us are growing up in a world that was dominated by Darwinian thought. I stole this chart from John Sanford. It's actually brilliant. Here we have Darwin's power to explain what we know. Starting back in the 1850s when he was writing his book, a little dip here in 1925 to Scopes monkey trial because evolution lost. And then we have a rise in power until the 1950s. What happened in the 1950s? Mathematicians started building mathematical models of evolution. Uh-oh. They all of a sudden realized it didn't work. They held on tight. In the 1960s and early 70s, they invented junk DNA. That allowed them another 20 years before the genomics revolution hit. And all of a sudden, Darwin's power to explain has plummeted. Why? Because the more complex life is, the less possible it is for evolution to explain it. If life were simple, evolution might be possible. But what do we see? Our understanding of life is getting more and more complex by the day. I've seen this in my scientific career. Just over the last 10 or 15 years, this explosion of engineering principles in the cell. And all the evolutionists are aware of this. So what do? We'll talk about that in a moment. So let's hit some of the, just very briefly, three of the big ideas we talked about in evolution's Achilles heels. First, natural selection. Is natural selection real? Oh, really? There are creationists who don't believe that. Does it work? How powerful is it? What can it do? And is it what evolution requires? Remember, evolution is a philosophy of history. Can natural selection explain the common ancestry of all things going back in time? Oh, but it works? Wait, you're creationists and you're saying natural selection works? Isn't natural selection the same thing as evolution? Good. Now, some things, I'm throwing this out. It might be the first time you ever heard someone say that. Let's talk about natural selection. We needed a model. See, I've been working with John Sanford for 11 or 12 years now. And right when I first met him, he was working with some computer scientists to write this computer program called Mendel's Accountant. It is the most comprehensive evolution modeling program ever written. In fact, it's more powerful than any other evolutionary modeling program I'm aware of because it can model the other programs. And by doing so, we've learned the assumptions that they're making in their programs that they're not telling us. Reverse engineering evolutionary programs, brilliant. So we had this computer program, and it came after he wrote the book that's on the table. It's called Genetic Entropy. So he had this idea. This idea is simple. Natural selection isn't powerful enough to remove all the mutations. Therefore, mutations should build up over time, and eventually all species will go extinct. Computer modeling demonstrates that's true. Theory, model, what about real life? How do you study evolution in real time? There are 7 billion people in the world. There right now, there's probably 100,000 human genomes that have been finished for living people. I can't study evolution if you only have living people. Now, we've got several dozen now ancient genomes, but they're all incomplete because they're fragmentary. That's not really good data. How do you study evolution with genetics? Well, you can do an experiment in a laboratory for a couple generations. There's a famous scientist he's now got E. coli in his laboratory, and every day they change the culture flask, and they propagate a little drop of E. coli into a new culture. He's done it now for, I think, 50,000 generations. But that's only 20 years. maybe 30 by now. That's not a lot of time. We needed something with a lot of generations in a long time, and what we found was the flu. Someone died, a woman died in Alaska in 1918 of influenza, and they buried her in permafrost. When they discovered that body, they were able to sequence an intact flu virus out of the woman's body. That gave us a 0 point, because the H1N1 virus apparently first appeared in the world population right at the close of World War I. In fact, it killed more people than died in the war. And now we have a genome from probably somewhere close to the original. Well, we got into the influenza database that the U.S. government has put together, and we were able to download thousands of H1N1 genomes, all the way up to 2009. In fact, 2012 is when we did the study. Remember the 2009-2010 swine flu outbreak? Remember how horrible that was? Remember how many people died that year of the swine flu? Oh, no, you don't. They dropped the story once they realized that nobody was dying from the swine flu. Why? Because the swine flu was 95 years old. And when where does the flu come from? It comes from ducks. If you've ever been swimming in a pond, you've been swimming through duck poop. And you've been swimming through a sea of influenza viruses. It is a natural virus in all waterfowl, and it doesn't cause disease. In fact, you realize that most viruses are benign and beneficial. You know that, right? You realize that there are 100 viruses for every bacterium in your gut? Did you know that? The viruses control the E. coli. Viruses are beneficial. You know that, right? Now you do. But take a virus that's tailored for one species, and one out of a billion, one out of a million, if it can jump to another species, that other species doesn't have control over it, and it'll burn fast, and it'll burn hot, and we discovered it will burn out. By the way, we published this in Theoretical Biology and Medical Modeling, an evolutionary journal. I am still a practicing scientist, and every once in a while, we can sneak one under the wire. What we did is we started here. 1918 is over here. We said 1918, we'll call that zero. And all the other sequences we had, these several thousand here, much more later on, much fewer earlier, we just counted up the number of differences from 1918 till 1932, 1940, 50, 60, 70. And look what happened. Mutation count went up. But here's something else that's funny. The year that the swine flu appeared in humans, the human version went extinct. The creationists noticed it. The evolutionists didn't. I'm studying this database, and I had to figure out which of these viruses were swine viruses and which were human. They're very different from each other because they've been circulating in pigs and in humans since the early 1900s, and they've picked up different mutations. You can tell the difference between them. And all the samples from 2010, 11, and 12 were swine. What happened to the human? It went extinct after 1,400 mutations. That's about 12% of his genome. 12% of his genome mutated, and it died. That's exactly, in fact, that straight line slope there, that's exactly the slope we get from Mendel's accountant when we modeled these things. About 14 mutations, the Y equals 14.406X minus, that's 14 mutations per year. In fact, that R squared, I have never gotten a line with a tighter fit to any set of data in my scientific career greater than that one. It is a linear. Linear? Yes. The laws of chemistry are building up. Actually, laws of chemistry. Listen, let me show you another chart. This is from a follow-up paper I published in the Journal of Creation. Not looking at individual mutations, but just the number of A's, T's, C's, and G's in the flu viruses over time. This is percent change. There's almost 1% fewer G's, and there's 1% more A's over only 60 years, 65, 70 years. Whoa, 1% change in the letter concentration? Why? Because the G to A mutation is controlled by chemistry. The C to T mutation, cytosine, can be deaminated. Chemistry, the amine just falls off. You know your chemistry? Remember your chemistry? No? All right. Oxygen can destroy DNA. And one of the things it does most often, it rips off an NH2 off of cytosine. It becomes uracil. DNA repair enzymes say, what's uracil doing in DNA? And they replace it with a thymine. And so the C to T is the most common. G to A is also very common. In fact, it's a little more common. I say the most common in humans, and influenza was actually a little more. The laws of chemistry are driving changes. That means natural selection cannot overcome the laws of thermodynamics. Entropy, genetic entropy, is a thermodynamics theory. The chemical reactions always go toward the lower energy state. Boom, in DNA too. The brilliant thing about Charles Darwin, he said, give me enough time and chance and natural selection can overcome the natural tendency of things. Evolution has to overcome the natural tendency or we're all just going to evolve into a nothing. We're going to fall apart. We're going to break down. So much for natural selection. There's 1,000 other anecdotes I would like to throw at you right now, but I'm going to skip and I'm going to move over to the study of genetics. Genetics is an amazing field. It's my field. It's my favorite field. I had a hard time deciding what I was going to do in my college. I was going to choose history or I was going to choose genetics. I choose genetics. And now, I chose biology and then marine biology. And then I ended up in genetics. And what's genetics? It's a study of history and biology. It's a study of how traits are passed from one generation to the next. My two favorite loves got merged into one field, and I am as happy as I can be. But if this is true, and we can use the tools that modern geneticists have invented, we can test theories of history. The Bible is a history book. Can we test the Bible? We can, but we have to be very careful because I know for myself, I've had naive assumptions I've made about the Bible and what the Bible predicts that were pretty stupid. But I'm reading the Bible, so, the Bible says that. Okay, and I go out and look at it, and after a while, I'm like, whoa. The Bible actually doesn't say what I thought it said. So we've got to be careful. But if the Bible is a history book, it should... The big pictures in the Bible should come out through the study of genetics, and we should be able to tell the difference between biblical history or evolutionary history. There are all sorts of statements in the Bible about genetics. Check this one out, Mark 10. But from the beginning, this is Jesus talking to the Pharisees. From the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. Jesus is not talking about the Big Bang, because people couldn't have existed then. If people existed at the beginning, obviously he's talking about the creation account in Genesis. How many people did humanity start with? 2. That is a profound statement of genetics. Because you can't have an infinite amount of diversity in 2 people. Now the evolutionist says that we came from a population with an effective size of about 10,000 individuals in Africa. You can have a lot of genetic diversity in 10,000 individuals. By the way, why do they say that we only had 10,000? Why not 1,000,000? Why only 10,000? I'm not sure what that means. Artifacts in like hand axes or artifacts in scientific data? Actually, it wasn't. They estimate there's probably about 1,000,000 Homo erectuses spread around the world. But the population of Africa got down to only about 10,000 because they'd have to explain the general lack of diversity amongst people across the planet. We have 1/5 the amount of diversity than chimpanzees do. We are incredibly closely related. I don't care what color you are incredibly closely related to every person in this room. Shockingly so. Why? Well, because who knows how many chimpanzees God created, but he only created two people. And that lack of diversity pretty much shows up today. And genetics, there's all sorts of things we can study about genetics. We can look at DNA. There's a DNA polymerase making copies of the DNA. What's it doing? It's making different messages. Notice they have different stopping and starting points. If you look at one letter in the genome, on average, every letter in the genome is incorporated into six different messages. And the messages have nothing to do with one another. It might be the color of your hair, how well you can see in the dark, how tall you are, how smart you are, and whether or not garlic gives you the burps. I mean, random things that have nothing to do with one another. Natural selection can't act upon that. Because if one letter change can do different things that might be actually, you might be selected for with this trait, but selected against with this trait, it breaks down. If life were simple, evolution might be possible. Life is not simple. We don't even write computers like this. We don't have overlapping codes in computer systems. Are you crazy? That's impossible. And yet it's in the genome. That means it's impossible to have it randomly if we can't even do it intelligently. Oh, there's other things about genetics that are amazing. Let's just talk about how you make a protein. You know that there's four letters in DNA, right? A, C, T, and G. Oh, sorry. Sorry, I'm looking at the wrong video. It starts off with the same frame. Let me back up here. DNA happens to be a very fragile molecule. It's got some problems. You have about 1 million DNA breaks per cell per day. You have 100 trillion cells in your body. What's 100 trillion times a million? That's how many DNA repairs have to be fixed in your body every day or you would be dead. DNA is the worst molecule for inheritance that you could possibly imagine in an evolutionary origin of life scenario. And yet there it is. There are single-strand breaks, double-strand breaks, deaminations, decarboxylations. There's all sorts of different possible mutations, and there's a different complex DNA repair system for each one. Every possible mutation has a different system of repair, yes, or you would be dead. How did that system start? How do you get DNA in the first living system before you have the DNA repair enzymes? I'm getting to origin of life now because I can't help it. Because what happened was I deleted the wrong video. I had these both of them here. So, oh, it's in the wrong place. And I took out the wrong one because I had the same starting frame. I didn't know which one was which. All right. So I just gave you a little bit of origin of life teaser. I'm going to show you a picture. This is a picture of human history. This is the human history of all the ladies in the world. What do you see? What's your first impression? What does that look like? Does it look like an explosion from a central point? I believe that Eve, actually the three daughters-in-law of Noah, are in here somewhere. The evolutionists put Eve here. Why? Because this is the halfway point between the most extreme African branch and the most extreme Asian branch. It's halfway. You realize that's the whole entire out of Africa, out of African Eve scenario thing? It's because it's the halfway point. But look very carefully. This group of people, these are the most common mitochondrial female lineages in Europe. These are also in Europe. They have a common ancestor right there. Is that obvious? Common ancestor. But look at the distances. These people have about half as many mutations as these people in the same amount of time. Can I say that again? The distance between, this is literally, this is a person who lived in history. A woman gave birth to two children. One of them founded this lineage and one of them founded this lineage. And these descendants have literally this many mutations, about 30 or 40. That's about 10. But these people have about 20, and you had the same great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother. So over the same amount of time, this branch has picked up about half the number of mutations as this branch. What does that mean? There's no molecular clock. The evolutionary out of Africa theory is based on the idea that mutations happen at the same rate. Therefore, halfway between the two extremes, about there, it's the same amount of time between here and here, and here and here. But it's not true. In fact, Sanford and I, we had a statistician friend of ours look at this, and he found statistically significant differences in branch lengths amongst the different branches. Means you can't put time on the human tree. Therefore, I am comfortable placing Eve somewhere in here. Come back tomorrow. I'm going to spend an hour talking about this. In fact, I'm going to spend an hour talking about this. This took me weeks to do this. I downloaded 800 full-length Y chromosomes from something called the Simons Genome Diversity Project. This is from the 1,000 Genomes Project. This is about 1,200 mitochondrial lineages. But notice how they're tightly clustered. There's a whole bunch of people here, a whole bunch of people here. It's because they sampled a lot of people in individual populations. But the Simons Project, they sampled two people from each population, and they took a lot of populations. I am here, R1A. These are the San Bushmen who live in the Kalahari Desert, the pygmies, everybody else in Africa. Wait a minute. The evolutionary root is here somewhere. Again, halfway between the edge of this one and the farthest one over here is about there somewhere. But these guys are the weirdos. Not that they're strange people. They're an odd people group. They're a small people group. They're isolated. They have very short population generation times because they live in a desert in a very harsh environment. The strange populations are driving the entire story. That makes me scientifically uncomfortable. Those are called outliers. You never base a theory on your outliers. And yet, the out of Africa theory is based on the outliers. I'm going to spend a long time talking about that. I'm going to give you one anecdote. My ancestor, William Thomas Carter, was an Irish potato famine survivor. He immigrated to the States in 1846 or 45. He was carrying R1B. It's the most common lineage in Western Europe, and my particular R1B1B2A1A2F, that's me, that's the most common lineage in Northwest Ireland. So I'm a guy with an English name and an Irish Y chromosome. I don't have any way to figure that out, but my Carter ancestor was Irish. There are other Irish and European lineages from like group I. In fact, I just read a paper today talking about a Scandinavian Y chromosomes. A lot of Scandinavians are from group I, and most of the ancient Y chromosomes in Europe are group I. So my great-great-great-great-grandfather could have had a neighbor from Ireland from group I. Very different people, aren't they? There's a group of R1B in Cameroon, Central Africa. I could be more closely related to the deepest, darkest skinned person in Central Africa than I could be to my Irish great-great-grandfather's next-door neighbor. All of a sudden, everything that Darwin ever said about races is destroyed. He said horrible things about races. Destroyed by modern genetics. And what do we have? Look at this. Noah. Not Y chromosome Adam. Y chromosome Noah is somewhere here in the middle. Come back tomorrow morning. We spend a long time talking about that. Other things in genetics we're able to study. Genetics has a lot of different subfields. One of them is dinosaur meat. Turns out that there is evidence that there is intact DNA in some of the best preserved dinosaur bones. This is crazy. This can't be true. as a young earth creationist, I have a hard time accepting this. Because I think this thing was killed, this Tyrannosaurus rex was killed in the flood about 4,500 years ago. 4,500 years is a long time. I'm incredulous. There should not be anything left in these bones. It should be all decayed away. But not only is there actually stinky, smelly meat. Wow, the thing's been rotting for 60 million years. No, sorry. Not only is there smelly meat, but apparently intact cells. And now these two cells here, can you see that green spot there and that green spot there? They stain these cells with a stain that I've used in laboratory. It's called DAPI. It's a flat molecule. It's got a couple benzene rings in it, and it sticks into the DNA double helix. And it's fluorescent green, so you shine ultraviolet light on it, and it fluoresces green. It only works with intact DNA. You need long-chain double helix, or else you don't get any fluorescence at all. So not only is there not just a little bit of DNA in these cells, but wait a minute, bacteria have DNA. Maybe there's a bacterium living inside the intact dinosaur cell in the non-rotten dinosaur bone. So these two over here, they stain them for a stain for a protein that bacteria don't have. But dinosaurs had it. And you have it. It's called a histone. It's a protein the DNA wraps around inside your nucleus. And this stain is red, and it lit up what looks like the nucleus. Yes, there is intact DNA inside dinosaur tissue. That means dinosaurs did not die out millions of years ago, because this is scientifically impossible, because we know how fast DNA breaks down. Oh, ancient DNA is amazing. Ancient DNA is one of the most amazing fields ever. You know, we can now sequence DNA from Neanderthals. Oh, yes, we can. We've probably done a dozen Neanderthal genomes now. And when they take like this Neanderthal skull. Actually, did you know that Neanderthal brains are bigger than yours? Yeah, it's a mystery. So take a skull of a child, Neanderthal child, and you know how they put clay and hair and eyeballs on it? So this is what the person really looked like. That's cool. Well, they did that to about a 10-year-old Neanderthal child. How come he doesn't look like half a monkey? How come he has green eyes and freckles? Because we've learned through DNA that Neanderthals were people. Homo sapiens. All of you are 2 or 3% Neanderthal. If you got strictly African ancestry, you don't have any Neanderthal DNA, because Neanderthals didn't live in Africa. Do you have mixed race ancestry or European, Eurasian, Native American ancestry? You're 2 to 3% Neanderthal. And there's about 60% of the Neanderthal genomes in this room. Oh, wait a minute. If all of you are a little bit and more than half of it's here, that means almost half or more than half of that genome is floating around in little bits and pieces amongst all of you. That means that they are people because they're sitting right here. The biological species definition says if two things can have children, they're the same species. I read a paper maybe a month ago. In fact, there's an article I wrote on creation.com called Skin Color Surprises. I had two big papers that were published, and one of them was on Neanderthal genetics, Neanderthal skin coloration, hair and eyes. And they realized that a lot of the variants that cause light skin coloration in Eurasians came from Neanderthals. Oh my. Everything you thought about Neanderthals growing up has been disproven because of genetics. Who are these people? They're people that lived on the earth after the flood. They're the first people to live in Europe. They got overwhelmed by a larger group of people who moved in later and had things like farms and cows and more children because they had more food, because they brought their food with them. But since people are people and people do what people do, we don't talk about that in church, Neanderthal babies were left behind. And now they're sitting here. Cool, huh? also gives us arguments about everything any evolutionist ever wrote about races. I'm glad they're all wrong. I could curdle your blood just quoting from you from Darwin's The Descent of Man, and the horrible things he said about the lack of intellectual and moral capacity of black, brown, and yellow people, but I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to give you an illustration. Many of you have seen this. These two adults here have a black father and a white mother. Different fathers and mothers. They're not brother and sister. So they're of mixed race ancestry. They had these non-identical twin girls. One of them is darker than her parents. She's African colored. The other one is lighter than her parents. She's European colored. What happens? We got black and white twins in one generation because the information for black and white was in the originals. This is our model of Adam and Eve. In fact, now that we've got more information about skin color than we did before, in fact, my article, Skin Color Surprises, documents that, it is clear that Adam and Eve contained all the skin color genes for the modern races. There's no evidence of evolution. We just have evidence of sorting and inbreeding, causing loss of diversity in specific populations over time. I'm going to skip forward a little bit. I've got a whole lot of things here on the origin of life, but I do want to have some time for questions and answers. Let's see, I'm looking at all my origin of life slides, that and that and that and that. Now I'm just going to skip to the end. Jesus visited Nicodemus the Pharisee at night in his house, and Nicodemus was struggling. He said, "Can a man be born again?" You know, John 3:16, right? This is a passage, a very famous passage. And Jesus looks at Nicodemus, the Pharisee, and says, Nicodemus, by the way, Nicodemus who went with Joseph of Arimathea, Nicodemus is the one who brought all the money to buy all the spices, like $100,000 worth of spices to prepare Jesus' body after he died. That Nicodemus. And Jesus says to him, "If I have told you earthly things and you do not believe, how can you believe if I tell you heavenly things?" You know, I believe that one of the main reasons why Christianity is struggling to remain relevant in today's world is because people have thrown out the earthly things in the Bible. That's the science and the history. They say those things aren't right. The Bible is wrong. And therefore, those guys who wrote that stuff about the spiritual stuff, you know, they're making that up as well. The Bible's just full of lies. What we see is that the spiritual baby gets thrown out with the earthly bathwater. It happens a lot. I am certain you know examples of this. If you put that in context of what I just said, and you're talking to someone who walked away from the faith, I'm going to say that most... I know sin is the excuse that people use for rejecting God and the Bible and walking away from Christianity. I got that. It's sin. But the greatest excuse for sin that mankind has ever invented is actually the evolutionary theory. Because if evolution is true from the Big Bang until today, there is no need for God at all. And that is a powerful poison in the minds of many people. So evolution's Achilles' heels is designed to as an antidote for a lot of that poison. There's a whole lot of things. Oh, man, that's so much I wanted to say, but I'm just going to cut it because I do want to answer questions. It's my absolute favorite thing to do. So while I'm wrapping up, let me tell you about Creation Magazine for those of you who don't know about it. I think that this is the tool that God used to keep me in Christianity when I was 18 and 19 years old. Not a joke. I'm actually a second-generation CMI scientist. The people who started this organization 40 years ago are now retiring. And I'm like taking over responsibilities that I still feel like a little kid. I can't believe I get to do what I do. It's fantastic material. Now, for those of you who have subscribed to this Creation Magazine in the past or currently do, we've actually changed the way we do our subscriptions. And we really like this a lot. It's a lot easier. It's $7.50 every 3 months. It's a quarterly magazine. So we send it out quarterly. So all we do is we ask for your address, you have to fill out credit card details, sign it, pay for it, and I'm going to give you 3 gifts. I'm going to give you a copy of our first movie we ever made, Darwin, The Voyage That Shook the World. We spent about $1 million filming a 1-hour documentary on the life of Charles Darwin. Fantastic presentation, really enjoyed that. First movie I was ever involved in. I've now been involved with 3 CMI ones in his Genesis history, so really 4. And we'll give you that if you sign up for the magazine. I'm also going to give you a copy of that Fallout DVD that I talked about earlier. It's 30 minutes long, really interesting stuff, and we actually it's designed to share with other people. It's some powerful stuff in there. I'm also going to sign you up for our digital version of the magazine. Every time we come out with Creation Magazine, we make it digitally available also, and we will send you an email, and in the link in the email, just click on it. It'll open up Creation Magazine on your phone, your computer, your tablet, whatever you have. Let me give you a strategy. Hey, son, I know we're arguing over this creation evolution stuff, but you know what? Check out page 22. I can almost guarantee you that most of the people you do that to will click on the link and go to page 22. If you just say, oh, here's Creation Magazine, read it, they won't touch it. You think that'll work? I think it's going to work, and I'll let you experiment with that. We'll also sign you up for all our snail mail stuff. Okay, you can do that now. Thank you much. It's that simple. We'll take care of you outside afterwards, and I'm going to go very quickly to questions and answers. First, however, let me point you to the Creation Answers book. We're going to answer 99% of your questions that you're going to ask me tonight. Well, maybe not. You're kind of a more nerdy audience than normal. You might step up the game a little bit. But most of the questions we do get asked actually are answered in Creation Answers book. Evolution's Achilles Heels is there. Mitochondria Leave is a talk that I'm not going to do tomorrow. But it's my first genetics talk I ever gave in front of 700 people. And basically I said, hey, you know, we've got answers. What I said was, the evolutionists have discovered evidence of Adam and Eve, Noah's flood, and the Tower of Babel. And I laid the information out. The high-tech cell is tomorrow's talk. I'm going to take the human genome and compare it to a computer operating system. And our heads are going to explode. Because we're going to realize very quickly that the genome is more complex than anything we've ever seen, ever. Therefore, it couldn't have evolved. Skip here to this one. And in all of my talks, I always end up with 1 Peter 3:15. A critically important passage. In your hearts, honor Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for reason for the hope that's in you. You do it with gentleness and respect. I tried to model that last part there. I was not sarcastic. I was not snarky, I don't think. I'm trying to make a couple jokes in there, but I was trying not to be disrespectful to the people who disagree with me. Why? Because harsh and sarcastic facts shouted in anger don't generally point people toward the kingdom of God. We can stand tall and confident on the word of God because we have answers to things that we couldn't even answer a year ago. Powerful answers. We don't have to be jerks about it. When we can engage our culture, we can talk respectfully, and we can share the gospel with people using this creation thing as a platform. Do you agree? Let's pray. Father, thank you for genetics. Thank you for natural selection. Thank you for science. Science is really fun. Thank you for creating a beautiful world for us to live in. We know it's cursed by sin and it's been marred by horrible things. We know human history has been bloody and horrible and awful. Lord, we know that you're a good God. And you're a benevolent God. And you've created a place for us to exult in. Help us as we explore this world and learn about this world to be able to glorify you in what we learn. But most importantly, Lord, help us as we learn to be confident enough that we would dare to open our mouths in front of people who are hostile to you. Give us grace, wisdom, and tact. It's easy to be a bull in a china shop when we get our mouth around the bit and just take off running with this stuff. But Lord, help us to understand the needs of other people as we share with them. It's not about science. It's about the heart. And Lord, we need mercy, we need patience, we need grace from you. In the meantime, all we can do is say thank you for the time we have. Amen. Okay, I've got 11:09 p.m. 8:09.